Hi, I'm Tom Hall. It's Monday, and this is Maryland Morning. The Baltimore City Council votes on whether or not to approve the appointment of Kevin Davis as the permanent police commissioner tonight. Today on Maryland Morning, Ben Jealous, the former president and CEO of the NAACP, discusses the report he released Friday that offers six ideas to reform the Baltimore Police Department. We'll be joined by activist Kwame Rose, who was part of the group of protesters who disrupted the committee hearing on the Davis appointment last week. Then Nathan Sterner checks up on the progress of the Mars rover Curiosity. Jaywin Russick reviews the new show at the Olney Theater, and I talk to two guys who make a podcast about pencils. Please stay with us. I'm afraid to talk to pencil podcasters by myself. We'll start with Ben Jealous and Kwame Rose right after the national news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's been 6 months since Freddie Gray died from spinal injuries while in Baltimore police custody, just one of a spate of police-involved killings of unarmed black men around the country that have shocked the nation. Freddie Gray's death triggered both peaceful protests and a wave of rioting in the city. And with the pending trials of the six Baltimore City police officers charged in the Freddie Gray case, the city is still on edge. Just last week, another video surfaced indicating that an officer spit on a black man who was handcuffed and lying on the ground. That officer, Robert Mesner, has been suspended with pay. Tension between police departments and communities of color simmers in nearly every major U.S. city, but it runs especially hot in Baltimore. Many believe the police are too quick to use lethal force on black citizens, too out of touch with the community, and too often allowed to act with impunity. On Friday, 2 days after protests erupted at City Hall over a City Council committee's recommendation to approve Kevin Davis as the permanent police commissioner, a broad coalition of city youth, community, and civil rights leaders stepped forward with a six-point plan to reform the Baltimore Police Department. Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP and now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, is lead author of the report called Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. He joined me in the studio along with Kwame Rose, an activist, hip-hop artist, and blogger who has been involved in the Freddie Gray and recent City Hall protests. We spoke on Friday. Good morning to you both and welcome. Thank you.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
So, Mr. Jealous, let's get right to it. Could you just simply summarize the six points that you're suggesting as the basis of the reform efforts?
The goal here is to really increase trust so that law enforcement works, people in the community feel safe, and the city's sort of foundation, if you will, in law enforcement, to the extent law enforcement is part of the foundation of any city, gets stronger, because we are a great city with a great future. Number one is we've got to fire bad cops. If your law enforcement officer is corrupt, if he has a history of violence, there's no reason why he should be on the force and receiving a paycheck from taxpayers. Two, we need to get rid of this gag order. Baltimore is out of step with the U.S. Constitution, I would say, because they literally seem to coerce people into giving up their First Amendment rights after their Fourth Amendment rights have been violated. And, you know, we heard a harrowing story today at the press conference of a woman who had called the police because her house had been robbed. The police came and ridiculed her for living in a poor neighborhood. And then when she called their supervisor to complain that they weren't investigating the robbery and they were ridiculing her, other officers came out that beat her up in front of her children and her mother. Then when she, 2 years later, received a settlement after becoming homeless for a period because she had they had given her seven charges that were unwarranted and unnecessary, sort of an extension of their abuse, trying to justify beating her up. And she couldn't get a job because she was charged with seven very serious crimes. They finally dropped all the charges against her, offered her a settlement again to help make reparation for lost wages and pain and suffering and bodily injury and physical rehabilitation. It was only $63,000, and not an incredibly high amount for all that she went through. And then they released the amount, her face, her name to the media, and said she's not allowed to talk. And then folks who claiming to be police supporters, but you got to wonder who they're really supporting, started attacking her on social media. When she responded, they demanded that she give them half of her settlement back.
So you're saying the gag order only applies to the victims, not to the police?
Yeah, it's really profound, and it certainly undermines, you know, both the role of the press and of the civil rights community and anybody who champions the rights of, you know, their fellow citizens and neighbors here in Baltimore. Third, we've got to get the body cameras out much faster. Other cities have done it much faster. There's no reason why we're dragging our feet on this. It's not a panacea, but it certainly is a step towards transparency. Fourth, we get into, you know, the need for us as a city to frankly shift our law enforcement priorities. You call it community policing. It's really just common sense. Police officers should not be rewarded for how many people they can charge. They should be, and certainly not for how many low-level nonviolent offenders they can charge. They should be rewarded for how many killers they help convict, how many rapists they help put behind bars, how many serial burglars they take off the street. You know, and you get in these conversations where they say, well, you know, we need the community to come forward to help get the killers off the street. Well, that's true, but you can't expect them to come forward if they don't trust that you'll actually follow through. We ultimately get into, I think, the sixth point. The fifth is happens to elude me at the moment, but the sixth point is that every officer needs to be trained in how to de-escalate situations. You know, there's been studies across the country that show officers every month spend hours, and every year hours and hours and hours in firearms training, but they don't spend very much time learning how to actually talk to.
Yeah, your report says something like 65% of their time is in firearms training and 5% of their time is in what's called de-escalation.
Yeah, which is just, you know, I mean, my cousin was on the force. He actually left. I was talking about this afternoon. He's on the force in the late 80s, early 90s, left because he said, Ben, back then we didn't have cell phone cameras. And I had peers who were getting away with killing people, and I just couldn't take it anymore. My grandfather was in law enforcement here for 30 years, a juvenile probation officer. And, you know, he would tell you, you know, if you just know how to talk to somebody, you can get a lot done. And a lot of these officers don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, the additional point in the report was that the police department should publish all of its policies.
Right. I mean, that
online.
Was sort of, I mean, our neighbor Connor Meek sort of drove it home when his bicycle got stolen. And he ultimately ended up at a police station here in Baltimore at 7 p.m. and the door was locked. It turned out that several police substations had had their doors locked from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. for some period of time. And, you know, most folks didn't know until they found out the hard way. He's reportedly was told that that's because that was a dangerous time to have the doors open.
Well, yeah.
And there you go.
And, of course, WYPR reporter Mary Rose Madden spoke on Friday with T.J. Smith from the Communications Office of the Baltimore Police Department.
Yeah.
Basically, their reaction to your report is that they're doing all of this,
yeah.
That these are in place, that they're on the way. That, you know, the body cameras, for example, may be a little later than the report suggests, yeah. But it's all in the works. What's your reaction to that?
Well, look, you know, the Internal Affairs Division is too small. And it needs, you know, more officers. And quite frankly, we should do as PG County did a few years ago, facing similar troubles, and make sure that the best detectives in the department are in internal affairs. And quite frankly, as long as there's still officers on the street that citizens know have beaten up their friends unnecessarily, and, you know, frankly, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars been paid out in total for what one or a small group of officers has done, they're not doing enough. So they need to speed that up. Two, with regards to the gag order, they're still hiding behind the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. We've read it and reread it. We've talked to lawyers about it. There's nothing in the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights that requires them to have this gag order in place. They're just hiding behind it. They can change that next week. The body cameras, look, cities less impressive than Baltimore have gotten it done much faster. You know, we are not a city that kind of puts up with mediocrity, and their pace is mediocre at best. And again, when it comes to community policing, you know, quite frankly, I, in my role as national president of the NAACP and as an organizer years before that, have worked with police chiefs across this country who have done more faster than what we're seeing right now. And what worries me, quite frankly, is this period between when a horrible case of police brutality breaks through the public consciousness, whether it's Freddie Gray or it's Rodney King, and when the verdicts are announced in the cases of the officers who have been charged, is a very sensitive moment for a city. And the cities who ultimately move quickly to a better place and start bringing down crime rates and bringing up trust are the ones who decide, like Sanford, Florida did in the wake of the Trayvon Martin killing, to actually make reforms aggressively and quickly. And the ones who just keep hedging, and it feels like we keep hedging, are the ones, quite frankly, who end up with even greater troubles on their hands, which is, of course, what happened in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdicts. All of us should be doing everything we can to get ourselves to a better place as quickly as possible. And that's why these 25 groups came forward together, even though they may have other wide-ranging agendas, and said, these things we can agree on, these things must get done. And by the way, these are all things our city can do right now. They don't require folk down at the state capitol to do anything for us.
Ben Jealous is the former president and CEO of the NAACP, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's the lead author of the report released on Friday, Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. It's 88.1 Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Kwame Rose is with us as well. Kwame, Kevin Davis appears to be headed for confirmation as the permanent police commissioner at a meeting of the city council tonight. You and others interrupted that meeting last Wednesday. How much can Mr. Davis as an individual affect the culture of this, you know, many-personed police force? Your opposition to Mr. Davis, is it because of him personally, or are you talking about problems with the department as a whole?
Well, thank you for having me. So I'm not necessarily opposed to Kevin Davis being the police commissioner. The shutdown at City Hall, and rather the disruptment of the vote for the appointment committee, was more about whether or not he is qualified to be the police commissioner because of his refusal to engage with the peaceful protesters he's literally sent his officers to attack. And another example of, you know, concerns about his qualifications are that he has a track record himself of police brutality. And the excuse he gave on Wednesday was that he was directed by leadership to do so. And so I know from my personal experience of being arrested on September 2nd by four officers in charge who hadn't made an arrest in 10 years combined, right? A lieutenant, a major, and two lieutenants, a major, and a sergeant. You know, they were told by leadership to do so. And so if you have leadership that's telling you to do something bad and you're complying, then you're one of those bad cops. And so, you know, we just need to change the culture of Baltimore City policing, and it should start with hiring Baltimore City residents.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. We're going to have more of this conversation about the report released Friday, Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore, with Ben Jealous and Kwame Rose after a break for the news. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. We're going to continue our conversation with Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's the lead author of a report released Friday called Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. Kwame Rose is an activist who's also with us in the studio. We spoke last Friday. So, Ben Jealous, when it comes to these recommendations, you're saying that these don't require action by the state legislature or the city council. I mean, these are things that Kevin Davis, if he's confirmed as the permanent police commissioner, can put into effect right now.
That's exactly right. It should be a roadmap for him on building trust and, quite frankly, accelerating his effectiveness. You know, all it takes is courage and commitment. I've worked with groups like the Police Executive Research Forum, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the major city chiefs, and so forth, for decades now, quite frankly, reforming police departments, quite frankly, because, you know, 20 years ago, I was just like Brother Rose here. It was, you know, Rodney King, and then it was Amadou Diallo. And I remember finding myself in a jail cell during a sit-in at One Police Plaza during the Amadou Diallo struggle. And I was in a jail cell with a bunch of guys just like my grandfather. They were all black pioneers in law enforcement, members of NOBLE, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives. And we were sitting there, and I was talking to them about, you know, why are you getting locked up trying to shut down City Hall? And they said, because this is not what we serve for. This isn't what we risked our lives for. And so at the end of the day, we're talking about, quite frankly, the leadership of the police department and the city having the courage to insist that our public servants do just that, that they serve the public. All of us.
Kwame Rose, let's talk about this notion of de-escalation, because there are disputed reports about what happened in the incident that you were involved in on September 2nd. That stuff aside, what's your recommendation as a person who is protesting, as a person who's been vocal, about how the police could better respond and how protesters and police could work together to make sure that everybody's First Amendment rights are realized?
So I'll make 2 points. The first point is that, you know, and when it comes to people exercising their First Amendment right, and even when we look at, you know, a real riot, right? A riot is something is people gathering without a cause and just burning things down. And that's generally what you have is white people do that, right? So what you have here since April is like literally an uprising of black bodies who are literally gathered in peace and trying to like basically say, we're tired of you all attacking us for no reason. The second point is even, you mentioned the video of Alfred Evans, right? And so Alfred Evans' family contacted me with the video, so I put it on social media. And in the video, you can clearly see the police officer walking down the street, provoking a situation, arresting a man simply because he could, and not trying to de-escalate the situation. Because it started with the backpack, Baltimore City Police asking whose backpack it is. And just to be the bullies that they and the thugs that they are, they throw the man's backpack on the ground. And the man has no way to defend himself against a Baltimore City officer. And then you have the officer spit on Alfred Evans, right? And then, so Wednesday, I had a phone conversation with the commissioner.
But that's a difference, and I don't mean to minimize what happened to Mr. Mm-hmm. Evans, but that's an instigation of an incident. That's not even, has nothing to do with de-escalation to the extent that, you know, protests, for example, the protests that happened after the death of Freddie Gray and that continue to happen during the trials for these officers and the hearings and stuff. How can these two groups, the protesters and the police, come together to see that people don't get hurt, that the law is obeyed, and that, you know, First Amendment rights are respected?
Well, for one, it's not even just the police response to protesters, it's the police response to black bodies who are literally saying, we're watching you do something wrong. And so a group of us, it was student organization, City Block, led by Michaela Gilliam Price, we came together and we all put together a list of 19 rules of engagement. We sent out an open letter to Stephanie Rawlins Blake, Commissioner Kevin Davis, and we even made it open to the public on BaltimoreUprising.org. And so there's 19 rules of engagement that we would like to see from police in response to protesters, right? And then at the hearing, we presented three lists of demands. First demand was that the commissioner adhere to the rules of engagement and retract his statement that he would treat peaceful protests like protest and a riot like a riot, because he seems to be the one who gets to declare what's a riot as opposed to what's a peaceful protest. The second demand was that the mayor fire housing commissioner Paul Graziano for his continuing to ignore and cover up allegations of sexual harassment and assault inside of Gilmore Homes, which was Freddie Gray's neighborhood. And the third demand was that, you know, money be reallocated to fund community schools and grassroots organizations to youth dedicated to social justice. You know, these are reasonable demands that mm-hmm. can be met.
And the Graziano case in housing is currently under litigation. We did a piece about that just last week here on Maryland Morning. Ben Jealous, we're out of time, basically, but let me ask you one question that's not discussed in the report, and that is the increase in crime that Baltimore is seeing, as well as virtually every other city in the country. Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular theory as to why all of a sudden in cities like Chicago, Atlanta, Los Angeles, New York, Boston, and Baltimore, there is more crime now than there was 6 months ago?
Unfortunately, all I know is I know enough to know that no one really knows. You know? What we do know is what it takes to get crime under control. And it requires, you know, quite frankly, once somebody, if you take homicides, once somebody commits the first killing, it's easier and easier for them to do the second, the third, the fourth. And so you've got to get them off the street quickly. And that's why we're so focused on rebuilding trust, because when you have trust, then what happens is people come forward with information and it helps close cases faster. But that starts with the officers actually going the extra mile to get every killer they can off the streets. People see that you're actually doing your job. And unfortunately, right now in Baltimore and the neighborhoods that my family historically comes out of on the West Side, you know, people don't feel like they can trust the officers.
Yeah, it seems clearly we got a long way to go before trust is part of the equation. But I appreciate Kwame Rose and Ben Jealous, both of you being able to stop by and talk about this very important subject. We'll have you back. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ben Jealous is the former president of the NAACP, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the lead author of a new report calling for reform of the Baltimore Police Department. Kwame Rose is a social activist and hip-hop artist who's been closely involved in recent protests over police conduct. And I'm Tom Hall.
This is Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. WIPR was in the middle of our fall pledge drive when NASA announced it had discovered the existence of water on the planet Mars. Now that our members have figuratively made it rain, we're going to focus on that Martian water. And planetary scientist Nathan Bridges of the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory is here to help. Nathan, good to have you back.
Very glad to be here.
And we'll start with a point of clarification. It doesn't actually rain on Mars, does it?
It does not rain on Mars under the current climate. That's correct.
Under the current climate. So it probably did rain on Mars at one point?
We think it did because there's good evidence for a lot of water in the Martian history.
But that's history. In the present, there is some water of some sort on Mars. Explain what it's like.
The evidence that we have is indicating that in some areas on Mars, in the summer, we have little trickles of water, very salty water. It's not a lot. It would not be enough to fill a bathtub or anything, but it occurs just in the summer under very limited conditions.
And the Martian summer is nothing like our summers. It's, what, 10 degrees, negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit at best?
Yeah, that's right. It's very cold, and then the atmosphere on Mars is very thin, so it would not be hospitable.
So between the light pressure and the extremely cold temperatures, it has to be super salty just to be in liquid form for even a bit.
That's correct.
One of the places on Mars that NASA thinks this water is the Hale Crater, and that's from observations made from space. We don't have any direct evidence of this water yet.
That's right. The evidence that we have comes from spacecraft in orbit around Mars that are making distant measurements. We have not actually seen these features from a rover or lander on the surface.
But we do have a rover on the surface, Curiosity. It is in the Gale Crater and not the Hale Crater.
Right.
But there is a chance that this water could be in the Gale Crater too?
Some people have seen features that they think could be like these water flows, but we have not identified them positively in Gale Crater. That's correct.
But you're looking for them with the...
We are certainly looking. If we found them in Gale Crater, that would be very exciting. And if we could investigate them, it would be something very interesting to look at.
And there is a question whether you could even investigate them if you find them, right?
Well, NASA has a restriction on having what we call forward contamination of potential biology on another planet. Just as something from another planet could contaminate us, we don't want to do that to something else and thereby disturb it and also ruining our chances for really studying it in the future. So,
since there might be some sort of microbe still sticking around on the Curiosity rover?
Potentially, and we're getting a bit speculative here that we'd actually see something like that. But if we did, I think we would have to assess whether we would investigate it close up.
And so it's not yet a decision that we're making in the concrete, just the abstract.
Very abstract.
So we're not sure, but we're definitely excited. What are you seeing with the Curiosity rover now on Mars?
So Curiosity has been on Mars for more than 3 years now, and it has been going on a journey looking at the history of Mars, just as if a hiker was going through the Grand Canyon and looking at the different layers. That's what Curiosity has been doing. And now we're at the lowermost layers of a mountain that's in the middle of the crater called Mount Sharp. And we are looking at those.
And the more you look at those layers, the more you are pretty certain that Mount Sharp now is where large bodies of water used to be.
That's right. The rocks that we find tell a story. All rocks tell a story. And the rocks that we see are mudstones, sandstones that formed in water, and also a type of rock we call conglomerates that also formed in water. So almost certainly there was a large lake that existed in this crater. So we're talking about a lot of water, not like a little bit of water that exists today on Mars.
And you're also doing a lot of drilling to examine what is in the stones you find.
That's right. So we can look at the rocks remotely, and we can determine what they're made out of remotely to some extent, but we really want to sample them just as a scientist would on Earth and bring it to a lab. So we can drill into the rocks and then put those rock powders into our lab on the rover and determine what they're made out of.
And what are you finding?
Well, it's quite interesting. The rocks in our area have large variations in the element silicon, quite a bit of variation. And we think this is due to water that flowed through the rocks after they formed, similar to water that sort of percolates through grounds of coffee in your coffee maker. We think that this water percolated through the rocks after they formed and altered them chemically.
The water would have brought silicon in or changed something
else? It probably removed other elements and made the silicon more abundant.
So the rocks
leached.
That used to be there had a lot of other stuff in them.
And
the water pulled it away.
Leached out.
Where would that stuff have gone?
It was transported somewhere else. I don't know.
Someplace yet to see.
Yes.
So where is Curiosity going next?
So Curiosity is going to continue on its journey up the slopes of Mount Sharp. On its way, it's going to see a lot of sites. And one that's upcoming, hopefully in the next few months, is a field of giant, dark sand dunes. These are sand dunes that are tens of feet high and very large, you know, tens of meters long and wide. And they're very dark. They're like black sand dunes. And we're going to look at those.
Will Curiosity have any difficulty climbing them? Is it going to climb them?
It won't climb them because that is judged as too risky. But we will get near them and we'll be able to sample them and look at them close up.
And while Curiosity has one rover companion on Mars right now, it's going to have more in the future, right?
That's right. There's two rovers on the books. The first one is being made by the European Space Agency in Russia, and that'll be launched in 2018. And then there's a 2020 rover being built by the United States with some foreign collaboration that'll be launched in 2020. And that one is something that I'm also involved with, and it's going to actually take samples of rocks and soils that will be brought back by a later mission.
So we're going to get to see, like, back here on Earth, what you're seeing now from thousands of miles away.
Eventually, yes. So the 2020 rover is just going to collect the samples. There will be a mission after that that will go to Mars and then bring them back to Earth.
Oh, to the future.
Yeah.
Nathan Bridges looks at Mars through the electric eyes of the Curiosity Mars rover from his perch at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory here in Maryland. Thank you so much for coming in.
I was glad to be here. Thank you.
More on what Curiosity is doing via our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner.
The Women's Voices Theater Festival continues this month, shining the spotlight on work by women playwrights. The Olney Theater Center is offering a play called Bad Dog. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review.
You can't miss it. The giant gash, the cavernous hole in the living room wall of the set of Bad Dog at Olney Theater Center. The hole is big enough to drive a car through. That's exactly what happened a few days before the play begins. Molly Drexler, a 40-year-old Hollywood screenwriter, catapulted off the wagon after a decade of sobriety. She plowed her Prius into her living room and ended up in the hospital. Bad Dog by Jennifer Hoppy House is part of the Women's Voices Theater Festival. It's also part of the American tradition of domestic dramas about addiction. Think Long Day's Journey into Night or Days of Wine and Roses. Like those plays, Bad Dog is a work of theatrical realism. Alcoholism, certainly Molly's alcoholism, might involve drinking yourself out of reality. But where Molly's mind goes in these episodes doesn't lead to any flights of playwriting fancy in Bad Dog. It merely leads Molly to black out. Under Jeremy B. Cohen's direction, Holly Twyford vividly portrays Molly as 50% narcissism, 50% self-pity. She's the baby of the family, and she's never grown out of this role, demanding attention and getting it. In this instance, Molly remembers how the drinking started, but not where it went or how it ended, as she explains to her sisters.
You didn't do it deliberately.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't remember.
You don't remember anything?
Not about this, no.
Well, what's the last thing you do remember, Crash?
More drinks on the plate.
Molly's whole dysfunctional family, not just her sisters, descends on the home she shares with her wife. This uneasy family reunion is one of several places where writer Jennifer Hoppy House gets heavy-handed with exposition. For example, there's no need for the sisters to tell each other that their mother and stepmother have never met, not in 30 years. The sisters are well aware of this. Like the play's protagonist, Jennifer Hoppy House is a Hollywood screenwriter. Her credits include Nurse Jackie and the current Netflix series Grace and Frankie. Bad Dog is her first full-length play, and her TV background may partly explain why some of the characters are thinly drawn. Molly's mother, played by Naomi Jacobson, veers toward the stereotypical worrying Jewish mother. And Molly's stepmother, a Hispanic former stripper, played by Gladys Rodriguez, primarily serves as comic relief. In a family whose members are driven by self-interest, it'd be a welcome contrast to get a deeper look at the bond between Molly and her wife, Abby. Abby's a therapist, and Alyssa Wilmoth Keegan portrays her as warm and low-key. But she has only known Molly since Molly's been sober. She's stunned by Molly's reaction to the idea of treatment.
Treatment is for crackheads, or for senators who get caught beating up hookers.
Molly,
I'm not going through withdrawal, Abby. I don't need to be locked away from the world with a horde of trembling smokers. I slipped, okay?
Bad Dog contains a couple surprises, though some may see them coming. To the playwright's credit, she leaves the ending unresolved. How you view Molly's fate depends primarily on whether you're a glass-half-empty or a glass-half-full kind of person. It's an ending guaranteed to prompt debate in the parking lot, which is all to the good. Olney's production is part of Bad Dog's Rolling World premiere. The play was produced in Orlando last spring. Director Cohen keeps the action moving and the dialogue is sharp. But some secondary characters and events are too pat, especially for a play about something as messy as alcoholism. At times, you could even say Bad Dog's bark is worse than its bite.
Bad Dog is at the Olney Theater Center through the 1st of November. It's part of the Women's Voices Theater Festival, and we'll have more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Theater critic Jaywin Russick will be back next Monday with her review of Spell Number 7. That's at Arena Players. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around after a break for the news. A podcast about pencils. I'm not kidding. Pencils.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So podcasts, of course, have been exploding around the U.S. And with that explosion, people are finding all kinds of niche topics to talk about. Our next guests have a podcast called Erasable, and it's all about pencils. Yep, wooden pencils. In this day and age of mobile digital offices and everybody living in the cloud, these guys talk pencils in all their glory. One of the co-hosts, Johnny Gamber, lives here in Baltimore. He joins me in the studio. Johnny has a PhD in philosophy and used to work in faculty development and higher education. Another host, Andy Welfley, who is a content strategist at Facebook, joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Tom.
We should mention that there's a third host of Erasable. That's Tim Wassum. He's currently teaching third grade, so he's working for a living and can't join us. But we appreciate you guys being in here. So, Andy, let me start with you out in San Fran. You've been associated with a website called Wood Clinch. There's another one called Pencil Revolution that you guys have. What is the deal with pencils? What is the lure of wooden pencils?
I mean, first of all, it's just a much nicer tactile writing experience than, you know, a lot of just a lot of other things out there. You know, you feel a little bit more connected to your words when you're writing them. With wooden pencils, you get to sharpen them, so you actually, like, you know, have to spend a little time to kind of prepare yourself. And I feel like you can really think about your words a little bit better. And also, it's like a fountain pen, right? It's kind of a fun anachronism. It's something, just an object of curiosity, but it's something that's still out there in the world. So there's plenty to say about a pencil.
Is there, in fact, Johnny Gamber, plenty to say about a pencil? I mean, you guys have a whole podcast. So what sorts of things do you cover in the world of pencil?
Well, recently we've covered sharpeners. We did a 3 or 4 episode series on notebooks, which was, you know, a giant rabbit hole. There's a pencil store in New York owned by a young lady named Caroline Weaver, who we've had on twice. We talked
about. And in her store, does she sell mechanical pencils?
No.
Only wooden pencils.
Wooden pencils
and entire
store. Yeah. It's small.
But
it's very, very well
done. I would imagine.
And we've had David Reese on of the Going Deep with David Reese fame. He wrote a book on pencil sharpening. We've covered pencil sharpeners, the history of pencils. We actually have Thoreau coming on as a guest, possibly next
Thoreau?
Episode.
Yeah. This is like in Henry David Thoreau?
Henry David Thoreau.
He's bringing him back
Thoreau.
To the
bed. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, very
yeah,
good.
He actually was a revolutionary pencil manufacturer.
Uh-huh. I had no idea. So now, for example, here's a little clip from the podcast concerning a very famous writer, John Steinbeck.
He wrote a letter on March 22nd where he says, "And now, Pat, I'm going into the fourth chapter. You know, I just looked up and saw how differently my handwriting is from day to day. I think I'm writing much faster today than I did yesterday. This gives a sharpness to the letter. And also, I have found a new kind of pencil, the best I've ever had. Of course, it costs 3 times as much. As much too, but it is black and soft and doesn't break off. I think I will always use these. They are called Black Wings, and they really glide over the paper. And brother, they have some gliding to do before I'm finished."
There you go. John Steinbeck talking about his pencils. Where does one dig up a quote from John Steinbeck on his pencils, Johnny?
Tim's a serious Steinbeck aficionado. He's collected Steinbeck's 3 favorite pencils, and he has a little shrine at home with a, I think it's Topps. They made some trading cards for writers, so he's got a little shrine at home. So I'm not sure where he found it, but if there's something Steinbeck related, he could probably get it.
That's pretty impressive, Tim. So now I'm interested in this notion that, you know, the tactile feel of the wooden pencil affects what you write, how you write, and your process of writing. You work at Facebook, for gosh sakes. I mean, are you allowed to use a pencil inside the walls of Facebook?
Well, I have to sneak them in, but it's really good for, you know, list making, or if I'm trying to write something that's short but has to be very thoughtful. It just kind of, I think it kind of slows you down a little bit. I do a lot of writing on the, you know, with a keyboard, which is really great for stream of consciousness and just getting things down on paper. But when you want to really like polish and kind of slow down, or if you just want to make a list, I use a pencil for that. It's kind of an object of curiosity around there, but.
So for I bet it is the biggest high-tech company, one of the biggest high-tech companies in the world, I can imagine. Yeah,
there's a lot of people who really like also are interested in pencils around there. So I've been proselytizing.
Knowing about pencils the way you guys do, is it kind of like sommeliers? I mean, Johnny, if somebody handed you a pencil where the number was, you know, somehow obscured, you know, was blurred out or something, you know, could you tell if it's a 1, a 2, or a 3 or something? Is it like wine? People know certain wines in certain areas of the world?
Probably not, because there's no standard grade. Like the whole number 2 thing is a total myth. Like companies have different definitions of number 2. And then even their models have different number 2s. So if it was a pencil that I'd had, maybe I could tell. But if it was a blank pencil, probably not.
So there is no industry standard.
If anybody can,
No, and my wife's a principal, and they were doing the PSETs recently, and they had to get number 2s. I'm like, there is no number 2 pencils. You can buy test scoring pencils that work much better, but of course they're really expensive.
Test scoring pencils. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a specific grade that's just made for tests to be read on the readers,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, they're really,
but
really dark.
That's not a number 2.
Yep.
So that's a myth. All right. Well, myth number 1, completely blown up. Now, I noticed on your website that, Johnny, for example, you recommend as your top 5 pencils, number 1, General's Pencil Company Cedar Point. But then, Andy, on your top 5, you're going with the Palomino Golden Bear. Now, what kind of tension has this caused between you guys? Have you ever sat this down, you know, with the counselor and worked it out?
We didn't speak for months.
Yeah, we almost didn't get a podcast going.
No, I think it's and those lists change every week. I think it's just kind of what we have on hand. Those are both like really great, you know, U.S. made pencils. I think a lot of it is just a matter of like aesthetics and also just performance.
All right, so aesthetics and performance. What else, Johnny Gamber, then makes a great pencil? What's the difference between a great pencil and a mediocre pencil?
The wood. They used to be made of eastern cedar until that became really rare, and they're made of incense cedar now. Incense cedar sharpens really well and has a straight grain, and that's the smell that we're all used to.
smell.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a tactile thing. It's a smell thing. It's a color thing. Like, for example, Andy, you recommended when one gets the Palomino Golden Bear to go with the blue.
Gorgeous. But they, with a bright orange eraser on the end of it, it's definitely a full body experience.
Dare I ask, how many subscribers do you have to your podcast?
We don't have an exact number of the, like an exact idea of the number, but we have probably about 3,500 to 4,000 downloads every couple of weeks.
So there is this big community of people who follow the world of pencils.
Yeah, we have a Facebook group that's reached, I think, 700 members, where people literally talk about pencils all day. Like, without us, we'll kind of pop in every once in a while and just see it, but it just kind of goes on.
All right. Well, I'm glad to see that the community of penciledom is good. And Johnny, you're wearing a T-shirt that said pencil is forever. And I notice on your website, your bumper stickers for Erasable are sold out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clearly a lot of interest. Right? Well, Andy, I appreciate you getting up so early this morning. And Johnny, thank you both for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Johnny Gamber lives here in Baltimore. He co-hosts the Erasable podcast. Andy Wellfleet is another co-host. He's joined us on the phone from San Francisco. We've got a link to the podcast, Erasable, at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning, grassroots efforts to improve black women's health, to grand dames of Baltimore jewelry, and celebrating a Nepalese holiday. Hope you can join us. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.